From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Now the story of a family whose future was abruptly canceled.
Arrested Development has returned after being canceled by Fox 7 years ago. But it's not on TV, it's on Netflix. Today, the show's creator Mitch Hurwitz talks about the show's dysfunctional Bluth family and his own family. Both include a brother named Michael. But
the show is not about my older brother, Michael, who's a surgeon in Newport Beach.
Yeah, why in the world
if
did
it
you...
was about you, Michael, would I call him Michael? I mean, think about it.
Also, we talk about the film Before Midnight with its stars Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy and its director Richard Linklater. It's the third film following a couple who met in the 1995 movie Before Sunrise. And Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album from former Drive-By Truckers member Jason Isbell. First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Later in the show, we'll hear Terry's interview with Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy, and Richard Linklater. But first, Mitch Hurwitz, creator of the TV comedy Arrested Development. After a 7-year absence, the Bluths are back in a new season of Arrested Development. But this season isn't on broadcast TV. It's streaming on Netflix. The Bluth family is perhaps even more dysfunctional, delusional, materialistic, and self-centered than ever. Here's how the series began back in 2003. George, the patriarch of the family and founder of the family business, had just been arrested for business fraud. His middle son, Michael, the most reasonable character in the family, played by Jason Bateman, was giving the latest news to the rest of the family.
Okay, guys, they are going to keep Dad in prison at least until this gets all sorted out. Also, the attorney said that they're going to have to put a halt on the company's expense account. Interesting. I would have expected that after they're keeping Dad in jail.
You know, Michael, Dad did name Mom as his successor. And I'm putting Buster in charge.
It's a good choice.
Buster? The guy who thought that the blue on the map was land?
He's had business classes.
Wait. 18th century agrarian business, but I guess it's all the same principles. Let me ask you, are you at all concerned about an uprising?
Okay, that's it. I'm done. I'm sick and tired of the greed and the selfishness and all the taking. Forget it. I got a son to think about.
But 10 years later and 4 seasons later, Michael still isn't through with the family. And Mitch Hurwitz isn't through with Michael and the rest of the Bluths. Neither are the show's fans, many of whom discovered the series only after it was canceled through DVDs or streaming and have been waiting for another season or a movie version. The show's become something of a phenomenon, known for its convoluted plots, pop culture references, and running gags. But you don't need to know anything about Arrested Development to enjoy what Mitch Hurwitz has to say.
Mitch Hurwitz, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on season 4 on Netflix.
And thank you very much.
So,
it's very confusing to be here.
So you've had a premiere unlike other premieres. I think you're the first like recurring TV series to have a whole season on Netflix before being anyplace else.
I think that's accurate.
Yes.
Yes, and for original programming.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
So and you've had plenty of season premieres of Arrested Development and other shows. So if I made you the offer right now that you get to do season 5 on a digital-only Netflix kind of situation or on TV, which would you choose?
Well, let's talk numbers. What are you willing to spend?
Oh.
No, I've turned it around on you.
Okay.
No. See, you didn't. This is why you don't run a studio.
It's the only
Your negotiating skills are horrible.
Okay. So I'm going to come up with a magic number a lot. Take money out of the equation.
This has been designed to lead to more story. And as those of you who have gotten all the way through the end of this know, there's a lot of story ahead of us. And that story is kind of mapped out already. So there's definitely a future to this family. whether it's a movie or another season or my new idea, which is a series of needlepoint patterns, which I think really would allow people to really focus on it. You know what I mean? Because I think it needs a lot of focus.
So this is a family that they all really like hate each other with good reason, but they're stuck with each other, which is part of the definition,
with
I guess.
Good reason. I think with good reason is the important qualifier there.
Yeah, and so no matter how much they want to or how hard they try, they can't really get away from each other. Have you ever felt in that situation yourself?
No, I'm very close to my family. I really am. It really was about how money, you know, money enables a lot of eccentricity. And the original idea, the original pitch, which I also think we didn't do, was what if, you know, a family loses their money and they go kicking and screaming into a better life? What if a husband and wife who've never, you know, even shared a bedroom, Tobias and Lindsay, are now forced to share a bedroom, and a child that lives in a fake home finally finds himself in a real home? And that was such a subterranean idea that I think everybody looked at the show and saw it as being very cynical. But there always was to me this idea of this hopefulness behind it, that they do need each other. And they are more effective when they're together. And early on, the criticism was, I mean, not the criticism, it was actually positive criticism. People would say, oh, there are no hugs, and nobody learns a lesson, which they were importing that idea from Seinfeld and kind of projecting it onto our show. And I always thought, no, there's a lot of hugs. They're learning all over the place. I come from the Golden Girls, you know? They're constantly hugging. So I don't know. I think it was the style and the tone of the show that was so unsentimental. But hopefully, you know, I always wanted there still to be emotion in it. But I think it was the unsentimental tone that made people feel like these are such scoundrels. And I guess they are.
You've said this
they're
was...
They're self-centered, you know. They haven't had to develop. That money allowed them to stop developing.
I read that you've said this was initially supposed to be based on your wife's WASP family, and then as you proceeded to write, the family got more Jewish, like your family. So, what did you consider to be different about your wife's family than your family?
Well, it wasn't really about my wife's family. I mean, I have to clarify that as well. At least while they're still alive.
So, how many siblings do you have?
The show is not about my older brother, Michael, who's a surgeon in Newport Beach. And it's also not about, well, it's a tiny, tiny bit about my younger half-brother, who's much younger than me and lives in Washington, D.C. So there's a little bit of, you know, I mean, what is honest in the show is there are family dynamics. Family speaks in code. Family has its own mythology. You know, in many ways, your family wants you to be what they think you are. My father said to me recently, hey, I didn't know you could write longhand. Or, you know, he said something like this. I didn't know you knew how to write in handwriting. I said, yeah, no, of course I do. I'm a grown man. Well, I didn't think you knew how. So I think you're thinking of when I was 8. Well, you definitely couldn't. I'll show you cards. And there's something fun about, you know, how your family won't let you change in a way, and the push and pull of like, no, I'm a different person. And of course, they're kind of right.
Push and pull is so important and so difficult when you're going through your teens and your late teens and your early 20s. And I think that's one of the reasons so many people try to go to out-of-town college, or at least when college was affordable.
They
used to. Did you do that?
I did. It took me a lot longer to go through my pushing away period. But I did go to school in D.C., even though I was raised in Orange County. So that was a big culture, you know, shock. But I think about the new series very much like that experience. You know, George Michael, who's always been kind of the soul of the show, that's Michael Cera's character, he's the one whose life has really changed. He grew up. He went off to college in our show. And part of the show is about how how he changes and how the family kind of adapts to, almost like when he went off to school, the center of the family fell away.
So, you know, you said your older brother, I think, is named Michael. And I was thinking, if I was writing a TV series and I wanted my family to know that the family in this series was not them, and I had a brother, Michael, I would definitely name my character Michael like you did, just as a sign, like, this isn't at all about
just
you.
Just hide in plain sight.
Yeah, why in the world
if
did you...
If it was about you, Michael, would I call him Michael? I mean, think about it.
Was that your thinking?
No, not at all.
Why
not
did
all.
You
actually,
name
it was
Michael?
I think it was a little plagiarism of The Godfather.
Oh,
I started there, and I liked how prosaic that name was, and then I liked the idea of everyone having the same name, which is kind of a Faulkner trick, you know, just to make it really complicated, force people to pay attention. There's a Michael, there's a George, there's a George Michael, there's an Oscar George, there's a George Oscar. There are two Lucilles, you know. Something about that enmeshment of the family that I really appealed to me. But it's really not about my brother Michael.
So, in the first season, two of the main characters live in a model home where, like, you know, the turkey on the table is a fake, like, porcelain turkey that they keep, like, a box of cereal underneath, which is what they're really going to eat. What kind of home did you grow up in?
You know, I only recently... This is like a therapy session. I only recently realized when someone asked me about the home I grew up in. I said, well, it was a model home.
No,
realized,
really?
Hey!
Seriously?
Yeah, I didn't realize that. But it wasn't like a model home in the middle of the desert. It was in a middle-class housing development, and so our garage was tiled. That was really the difference between our home and the other homes. And, my parents got divorced when I was very young. So I kind of went back and forth between the two homes. They never loved me. Wait, no. Can we delete that? Oh, God. What have I said? No, it was a very tight family. It was actually a very tight family, a Jewish family. And I think maybe that's what's been so interesting to me about the Bluths, that they did not have the warmth that my family did.
So,
which I think is probably more realistic.
Did religion play much of a role in your family's life when you were growing up?
No, not at all. No, really not at all.
Very secular Jewish?
Not at all. Yes. Yeah, I'm Jewish. That's another way to say that.
Okay, so at age 12, you started a chocolate chip cookie business called The Chip Yard?
Yes. You've done your research.
So,
kudos.
Clearly, this must be connected to the frozen banana stand that your characters create in Arrested Development. But tell me about the chocolate chip.
Do you know, I never realized
Never
that.
Thought of that.
Just
I know.
The second breakthrough.
Just now.
No, I know. I don't mean to be such a smartass. No. That is absolutely true. That my brother and I, in 1976, started this cookie business that was really going to be just like selling cookies in front of our house. But it was during my father's part of the custody half of the summer. And he really encouraged us to rent this little, what used to be a taco place. And since we were selling cookies in front of the house, he said, why don't you just sell cookies there? So we started selling cookies and burning our little arms and working very, very hard. And about 3 weeks into being opened, a reporter for the LA Times came down. And he said, can I speak to the owner? And I said, I am the owner. And he ended up doing a story. Yes. And he ended up doing a story about it, which was ended up running. And we'd sold at that point 30 cookies a day or 60 cookies a day. And then this article ran on the front page of the View section on a Sunday LA Times. And the next day we sold 6,000 cookies.
Oh, no.
And we had to shut down and get bigger mixers and bigger ovens. And suddenly, you know, I was the cookie boy. And I spent the rest of my summers in this hot little shack, standing there like George Michael, saying, 10 cents gets you nuts.
Wow.
So that's the saga of the Chipyard. It's still around. There's a Chipyard. My father then... Oh, well, the punchline to it is the lesson about how tough it is to make a buck. Suddenly, we've got this cash business. And, you know, we didn't have a cash register. You know, we just throw the money in a bag. And suddenly, we got all this money coming in. And we're, you know, pumping the pinball machines full of our hard-earned money. And my father realizes, you know, to quote a trope itself, I've made a huge mistake. And the boys are buying prostitutes. I mean, it was out of control. So so he immediately came up with this idea, which was, hey, you boys are going to pay for your own college education. We're putting this money into a bank, and you're going to have the satisfaction of knowing it's your money you're wasting on college, not mine. Not really. I'm exaggerating. But we did. But it did end up, you know, paying for our college. And then Michael went on to medical school, so he really owes me. He's got to pay me back one of these days.
So you've worked in TV a long time. And before Arrested Development, one of the shows you worked on, in fact, the show you got your start on, was Golden Girls. And I'm wondering what it was like for you as a young man, first job in television, to be working on a show about, was it three or four older women living together in Florida?
You know, it was great. Really, the secret to that show, by the time I was on it, was, you know, and always, I'm sure, these women are so wonderful. Bea Arthur and, you know, Betty White and Rue McClanahan and Estelle Getty. I mean, they were so talented. And you really could write jokes, and they would say them and make them feel like characters that break your heart. But I did, I really did. Like, I subscribed to ARP, the magazine.
AARP.
You know, AARP. And I would, you know, there were all these jokes. In my episodes, there would be some reference to Estra Tab or something that I'd picked up in ARP. So I was really trying to connect with my audience. And it was an amazing learning experience. And it was, I met Jim Vallely there, who I've continued to write with for many, many years. And I really learned about joke writing more than anything. I mean, that was a great lesson in how to craft a joke and get a laugh.
Tell me something you learned about crafting a joke.
Well, in many ways, all the things I learned are the things that I try not to do now. For instance, you have to put the punchline after the setup.
seven episodes later.
You're not supposed to do it seven episodes later. That's one thing. I learned about throwing yourself off a cliff when I learned about getting over self-consciousness of pitching a joke. That's really, when you start that process, you're in a writer's room for the first time. I was just immensely self-conscious. In fact, it really wasn't until I was running my own show and I got my ego out of the way and suddenly it was just desperation and we had to finish a script that I really started pitching a lot in rooms. But that was, I remember Jim Vallely, who's, you know, as I said, he's one of the executive producers of Arrested. And I remember being in an early room with him, and there was a scene where Blanche was opening up birthday presents, and Jimmy yelled out, "It's a blouse!" And everybody looked at Jimmy. I guess Rose had given Blanche a present, and Jimmy yelled out, "It's a blouse!" And everybody looked at Jimmy, and he took a second, and then he said, "You said you wanted something crotchless." I remember, and I said to him after, I said, "Did you know you were going to say the crotchless thing?" He said, No, I had no idea. Just painted myself into the corner. I love that. I think that's such an important part of comedy. You know, we do it all the time on Arrested, just paint ourselves into corners.
Oh, well, that's
so funny.
You know,
and then try to get out. Yeah. It's all about constraints, you know?
So there's lots of gay jokes in Arrested Development, and one of the characters, Tobias, who's the brother-in-law, he seems so clearly to be gay, though he doesn't have a clue about that. And so the jokes are like, he'll say like, "Why do people think I'm gay?" And then he'll just like break into a show tune, or like he and his wife are both packing for trips, and she takes out this like, you know, cute little piece of round luggage, and then he takes out the identical piece. So do you have gay writers on the staff, and do you feel like gay jokes like that should be like vetted with gay people to see like funny or offensive?
No, quite the contrary. I'm very scared of gays, or like it's almost like a phobia. You know what I mean?
you mean like a homophobia?
I think you know, my goal with the show has always been that the Bluths are wrong, right? So it really isn't the point of view of the producers that Mexicans are inferior, or black people, or poor people, or gay people. We've even taken a couple of shots at Jewish people, but it gets complicated because we can't quite decide if the Bluths are Jewish or not. No, I think the idea of that joke or that character trait is just somebody who doesn't appear to have any insight into themselves. That's more about being oblivious than about being gay. And it's not, you know, it's really not, I don't know, I don't really have a philosophy about it. It just seems sort of funny to me that a guy would not understand what he says or you know, in many ways we think like there might be a reason that he seems gay when in fact it's just that he's with the wrong woman. He's just forcing him into self that does. How do I say this? This would be a really good time for me to say I'm gay. but I'm not, damn it. Yeah, I guess I'm gay. No. It really is just about it. He's as oblivious about who he is as Lucille is about who she is. You know, in the pilot, she says, "I love all my children equally," and we very quickly see she doesn't, or she might not even care about her children at all. We don't know. She probably does.
So you are 7 years older now than when Arrested Development premiered in 2003. Do you see life in general and Arrested Development in particular more from the perspective of father than son now than you did when it started?
How interesting. I think so. I mean, I think I really did see it from George Michael's perspective a lot. And I still do. I mean, I try to see it from all their perspectives. But I definitely have... I have more appreciation of it. I mean, that's not exactly what you asked, but I really, that's the amazing thing about getting the second chance to be with these people after all this time is that I felt just deeply appreciative. You know, you don't get second chances often in life. And beyond that, you don't get creative opportunities like this. You know, this was a giant expenditure on Netflix's part. And they just let me go. And because of the nature of the way we shot it, nobody could really see scripts ahead of time because on any given week we'd be shooting something from, you know, eight different shows because the actors weren't always available. So on the first day of shooting, I think we shot things for six different shows. And as a result, we had to constantly be ready from a production standpoint to shoot anything in this whole saga. And the result of that was that nobody could really be ahead of what I was doing. They really had to trust me. And I took that responsibility very seriously, you know, but it was enormous creative freedom. There was no testing of the product because there was no time to do it. And it really just felt like such a rare opportunity. So as I think in the old days where I was just constantly anxious because there was so much work to do. I remember even the night we got the Emmy, and as I was standing on stage thinking, yeah, but we don't have next week's episode.
Oh, yeah.
I got to get back over there. We don't have the act break. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know why Job's doing that. And this time I still had all those, you know, creative doubts and feelings and anxieties, but I definitely had more perspective on what a privilege it was.
Mitch Hurwitz is the creator of Arrested Development. All 15 episodes of the new season are streaming on Netflix. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from a former member of the Drive-By Truckers, Jason Isbell. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
The new movie Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of a couple who met on a train in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. Coming up, we'll listen to the interview Terry recorded with the film's director, Richard Linklater, and the stars, Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. That's ahead on Fresh Air Weekend.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album by Jason Isbell, the musician who came to prominence as a member of the southern rock band The Drive-By Truckers. He had to leave that band in 2007, in part because of substance abuse problems he mentions in his new solo album, Southeastern.
Hard on the run, keeps a hand on the gun. You can't trust anyone. I was so sure what I needed was more. Tried to shoot out the sun. In days when we raced, we flew off the page. Such damage. I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone.
When Jason Isbell was part of the Drive-By Truckers, his guitar contributed to the band's sometimes magnificent squall of noise, and his songwriting to the eloquence that raised the band high in the Southern rock pantheon. But the Truckers were led by two first-rate songwriters, Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley. Whatever the backstage drama that led to Isbell's departure, from a purely artistic standpoint, a parting of the ways now seems inevitable. Especially when you hear the meticulously detailed, frequently much more quiet music Isbell is making as a solo act.
Mountains rough this time of year. Close the highway down. They don't want. I've been fighting second gear 15 miles or so, trying to beat the angry snow. And I know every town we're passing through, what good does no one do? No one to show it to. And I've grown tired. Traveling alone, tired of traveling alone. I've grown tired of traveling alone. Won't you ride with me? I've grown tired.
Isbell has been releasing his own album since leaving the Drive-By Truckers in 2007, frequently with a band called the 400 Unit, named after a psychiatric ward, which gives you some idea of where his head was at. Was is the correct tense to use here, because Southeastern, billed as simply a Jason Isbell album, is the first release he's put out since going public about his alcoholism and rehab. Throughout this new album, there are references to lost weekends, drinking Listerine when the booze runs out, and swearing off the stuff. But Isbell is too much of a language-drunk artist to permit his work to turn into a recovery memoir.
On a large, on a whim, I said there's two kinds of men in this world, and you're neither of them. And his fist cut the smoke. I had an eighth of a second to wonder if he got the joke. And in the car headed home, she asked if I had considered the prospect of living alone. With a stain held in my eye, I had to summon the confidence needed to hear her goodbye. And another brief chapter without any answers blew by. And the songs that she sang in the shower are stuck in my head.
At one point in that song, called Songs That She Sang in the Shower, Isbell says, Looks like I'm here with the guy that I judge worse than anyone else. And you know that the guy he's referring to is himself. The words and music are scrubbed clean of self-pity and instead give off an energetic ruefulness of the kind that's one of the best combinations of sobriety and clarity. And Isbell has by no means forsaken his wild side. Look no further for proof of this than the careening honky-tonk blast called Super 8.
Gonna die in a Super 8 motel just because somebody's evening didn't go so well. If I ever get back to Bristol, I'm better off sleeping in a county jail.
Southeastern combines rock, folk, and country music in a manner that permits Jason Isbell to be as literary as he aspires to be, while also keeping him rooted in pop music forms that prevent his songs from becoming excessively flowery. He said in a recent interview that he's been listening to Tom T. Hall records from the 70s, and Hall's kind of straightforward storytelling is exactly the right direction to be going in. But in another recent interview, he said he's been reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, to which I would say, Jason, enjoy and thank God and the 12 steps that you are not Raskolnikov.
Ken Tucker reviewed Jason Isbell's new solo album, Southeastern. Coming up, we'll hear the interview Terry recorded with Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy, and Richard Linklater. Their new film is called Before Midnight. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Read the good book, studied it too, but nothing prepared me for living with you. Lock me up tight in these shackles I wear, tied up the keys in the folds of your hair, and the difference with me is I used to not care.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose commission to build a healthier America works to improve health where Americans live, learn, work, and play. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
From the sky we look so organized and brave. Walls that make up barricades and graves. Daddy's little empire built by hands and built by slaves. From the sky we look so organized and brave. In the heat I saw you rising from the dirt, drunken tears and tugging at your skirt. If only you could tell me then what part you got hurt. In the heat I saw you rising from the dirt. Take my hand, baby, we're over land. I know I'm flying over.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new movie Before Midnight stars Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, who wrote the film, with its director Richard Linklater. We're going to hear part of the interview Terry recorded with all three of them. Before Midnight is the third film in a series that began with the 1995 film Before Sunrise. In that first film, Ethan Hawke's character Jesse and Julie Delpy's character Celine meet on a train from Budapest. He's an American on his way to Vienna to catch a plane back to the United States. She's returning home to Paris. After getting absorbed in conversation on the train, they're reluctant to part, and Jesse tries to persuade Celine to get off the train with him.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you. You know, I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun. Come
on. What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around. And it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train. All right. Think of it like this. Jump ahead 10, 20 years, okay? And you're married. And only your marriage doesn't have that same energy that it used to have. You know, you start to blame your husband. You start to think about all those guys you've met in your life and what might have happened if you picked up with one of them, right? Well, I'm one of those guys. That's me. You know, so think of this as time travel from then to now to find out what you're missing out on. See, what this really could be is a gigantic favor to both you and your future husband to find out that you're not missing out on anything. I'm just as big a loser as he is, totally unmotivated, totally boring, and you made the right choice and you're really happy.
Let me get my bag.
Jesse and Celine spend the night walking and talking and falling in love. At the end of the film, when it's time for Jesse to catch his plane, he and Celine agree to meet again in 6 months, but they decide not to exchange phone numbers or addresses. The next film in the series, Before Sunset, jumps ahead 9 years. Jesse and Celine never met as planned, but Jesse's come to Paris to promote his new book, a fictionalized version of that night he spent with Celine. Celine shows up at the end of his reading at a bookstore, and their relationship picks up where it left off, in spite of the fact that Jesse's now married, unhappily, and has a son. At the end of the film, Jesse's scheduled to fly back home to the U.S., but he decides to miss his flight and stay at least for the night with Celine. In the new film, Before Midnight, Jesse's divorced from his wife and is living with Celine in Paris. They have two young girls with whom they've been spending part of the summer at a writer's retreat in Greece. Jesse's a novelist, Celine is an environmentalist. And now they're having the kind of problems couples and parents have. Celine's insecure about how age and motherhood have affected her looks. This scene is an echo of the first film when they met nearly 20 years ago.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
No, but really, right now, as I am, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Well, I mean, you're asking a theoretical question. I mean, what would my life situation be? I mean, technically, wouldn't I be cheating on you?
Okay, why can't you just say
no,
yes?
No, I did. I said, of course.
I wanted you to say something romantic and you blew it, okay?
Okay, okay. All right, wait. If I saw you on a train, okay, listen, I would lock eyes with you.
Uh-huh.
And I'd walk right up to you and I'd say, hey, baby, you are making me as horny as a billy goat in a pepper patch.
Stop it. That's disgusting. Billy goat? No, the truth is, okay, you failed the test. And the fact is, you would not pick me up on a train. You would not even notice me, a fat-ass middle-aged mom losing her hair.
Okay.
Yeah, that's me.
You set me up to fail on this one. You did, all right?
True.
All right? But in the real world, Baldy, okay, on game day when it mattered, I did talk to you on a train, okay? I did that. It was the best thing I ever did.
Really?
Right?
Look at the goats.
Hey.
Hello.
But, you know, that's not even a good question, all right? The real question would be, if I did ask you to get off a train,
yeah,
Would you get off with me?
No, of course not. I have people waiting for
me.
Richard Linklater, Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy, welcome to Fresh Air. Were you all in agreement that there should be a third film, or did you have to, like, work that out before you agreed?
I think we kind of all eventually came to agreement.
This is Richard Linklater speaking.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of evolves. We joke about it for 5 or 6 years, and then maybe it takes a different tone where it seems more real. The possibilities of Celine and Jesse kind of start sounding more substantial. But we have this, you know, wonderful couple years of gestation time to think about it. So when did it become real this time?
Well, I don't think it ever becomes real.
Until we're all there in a room on the location, kind of.
Until we all agree that we want to be writing about the same thing.
Right.
You know, I mean, if that we see them in the same place. And, I mean, I guess that happened when we all kind of realized we wanted them to be together. And, you know, the first two films deal so much with romantic projection. And the third one, we all really felt we couldn't do that again. We needed to really try to address the harder, more difficult aspects of daily life and what it means when you get what you want. And what do you do with what you want when you have it? And do you still want it? And when we kind of all agreed that we all wanted to write about that, then it takes off.
Mm-hmm. So you agreed that this would be about a very tense moment in their relationship where they're quarreling and could conceivably even break up.
Yeah, it's a like moment of where they have to make a choice. You know, I think the films, each film is catch them at a moment where they make a choice. And that's how our lives is carved, you know, more and more as we go into, you know.
By these choices.
By these choices we make. And I think every time we meet them, they're at that moment, basically. The choice to get off the train, the choice to miss the plane, the choice to, what do we do now, you know? Do we separate? Do we stick together and figure it out? What do we do?
There's a key scene in the movie, a long scene, where the couple is at a writer's home that's kind of like a retreat in Greece. And because Ethan Hawke is a writer, he and his wife and children have been invited there to spend a few weeks. And as a gift, they're given one night at a hotel, just the couple themselves, and the people at the house are going to babysit their twin children overnight. So this is the first time they've been alone as a couple without worrying about scheduling for the kids or cleaning up. And the plan is to have like a romantic evening, bottle of wine and some sex. And instead they end up having, a pretty complicated fight with each other about things that have been building up. So can you talk about writing the fight and making the fight seem real to you?
I think the idea to the fight is to not look at it as a fight necessarily. It starts off a love scene, certainly. They try not to fight. And I think that was the key. They really want to be heard. They would like this one issue that's been identified early in this film. And in fact, this issue of Jesse's son, Hank, and trying to be a bigger part of his life is probably that fault line in their relationship was there at the beginning. That's been there for 9 years, and it's probably keeps emerging in their lives. And it's just one of those conundrums, you know, they find themselves in. This is a tough spot. So,
well, the two characters have really different approaches to fighting. Julie mm-hmm. Delpy, your character really kind of needles Ethan Hawke's character, and she's kind of confrontational. And Ethan Hawke, your character is more like you're implying certain things, but you're not necessarily coming out and stating them. And it's kind of ambiguous whether you want certain things to happen or not. And so, you know,
he's sly, more slyly.
I like to say about this scene, you're in the hands of two master manipulators. This fight was all of our greatest hits. The things when you're in a fight, you think of an hour later, what's the exact response to that? Okay, well.
In this version, you had the idea at the right moment.
That's like, the great thing about writing a fight. It's like you can really think about the right answer.
That's what made it fun and funny. You know, I see the fight. I enjoy it when audiences laugh a lot during the fight, because even though Jesse and Celine, the farthest thing from their mind is any of this could be possibly funny. But the three of us as writers thought this was really funny, and we like it when audiences think it's funny.
Okay, I need an example.
Other people's problems are funny.
One line that you found like really funny that's one of your greatest hits, or someone you know's greatest hits that you use for the film.
Oh gosh.
Well, my favorite is one of Julie's is that men believe in fairies. You know, little fairies who sunscreen the kids, little fairies who empty the dishwasher. That was
in other stuff that she's doing. Men believe, you know, that the wives and mothers do. Men believe little fairies come and do.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines is when Celine's expressing her frustration at the burden of being a parent and working, and she doesn't have time to do, you know, her passion, which would be to write more songs and be a creative person the way, you know, Jesse has a lot of time carved out in his life to be a creative person. He's a novelist. And so she's complaining about not having time. And when he comes back with, well, I wish you would, you know, find the time to do that. You somehow managed to find the time to complain, you know, about 8 hours a day. So use that, you know, something like that.
It's like time to do scales.
If you use that time to work on your scales, you'd be Django Reinhardt.
Yeah.
So, Julie, there's a scene I'm sure everybody will be talking about where, you know what it is, where it's in the hotel room where you're alone with, you know, Ethan Hawke's character. And you had started to make love, but then got into a fight in the middle of it. So you're lying there with your shirt off. But it's not sexy to him at this point. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's seen you a lot of times. It was sexy when you were making love. But now that you're just sitting there talking or arguing, just seeing your breasts is not arousing to him.
It's not in an
erotic way.
Situation. Yeah. Well, I thought that's what happens when you're in a relationship for a long time. Like, you know, seeing someone naked is not necessarily in a, you know, sexual way. You know, you're not objectified anymore, which is interesting because it's actually usually in movies women are naked to be objectified, and in that scene she's not at all.
She's talking about her stepson's science project. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more funny. It's more for a funny thing. It has no, you know. I mean, I'm actually being asked this question only in this country so far. So.
Well, we were trying to get at the utter familiarity they have with each other, that's not titillating in the...
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, whoa, accents. I haven't seen those before. Wow.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, and you were comfortable doing it. There was no question for you.
I'm comfortable with... I mean, it's never super comfortable to be in front of a crew naked, but I had to
you
make...
You wish the air conditioning was on.
Was on, yeah. Right. It was really hot.
And so hot.
Yeah, we were dying. But, you know, when I act, I try to make abstraction of a lot of things, and that's part of what acting is. You know, it's like you're just doing a scene and you agreed to do that. And, I mean, I co-wrote this. It's not like I was forced to do this, you know. And I was probably the one that suggested it, or we all agreed on it. So, you know, we thought it was funny.
Richard Linklater, the idea for this first film, Before Sunrise, started with you. And I've read that it's based on an experience that you had meeting somebody, I think, in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Yes. So would you mind telling us what that actual life experience was, that the story that inspired the movie?
I think a lot of people have had that experience, I hope. You know, you're kind of unattached, young, especially when you're traveling, you're kind of open for these experiences. You know, I was just at a toy store and I was in town for one night visiting my sister on my way back to Texas from New York. And I don't know, this young woman was kind of flirting with me a little bit, or we had that little connection. And so I was bold enough to ask her, like, well, when do you get off? Do you want to hang out after? You know, I probably would never do that otherwise. But, you know, I was kind of, what the hell? I'm only here one night. I'll never see anybody again. So she was like, sure, you know, I get off at 10. So we just ended up walking around Philly all night. You know, that was it. It was but, you know, filmmaker that I was and aspiring to be, you know, where nothing's real unless you can make a film about it. I remember 3 a.m, we're walking around and I'm saying, you know, I want to make a film about this. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, you know, this feeling, you know, this flirtation, this connection we're having, you know, I just think that's a movie. So, you know, it was just this, I think the idea was to make a film about an emotion or an essence. There wasn't a big story there. It would really just be exploring a connection between two people, which isn't the stuff of probably great narrative. There's not a lot of plot there. But from a character standpoint, I thought that could be a movie.
Did the woman who you met in Philadelphia at the toy store know that Before Sunrise was inspired by your night with her?
You know, this is a really sad story, but I found out about 2 or 3 years ago that she actually tragically died young in a motorcycle accident. And I didn't know that until a friend of hers put this together, had seen the films and got in touch with me and kind of put this together and asked me, were those films based on my friend Amy? You know, because she told me once she met a filmmaker, some guy from Texas, and I looked up your thing, and you're, you know, so it was really so sad.
So did she die before, sunrise?
Yes, she died right before we went to Vienna to shoot before. She wasn't alive even for the, and it, she kind of echoes through the films because I always felt I would see her, like she would show up at a screening. You know, when you make a film, you're in public quite a bit. You're at a, you do screenings, you're at a film festival, and I run into a lot of old friends. And I figured, just in my mind, like, oh, she's going to, you know, I have a screening in Philadelphia. Maybe she'll be there. Maybe she'll be in New York. Maybe she'll, you know, and she never showed up. So I always felt, you know, even in the second film, I think that, in a way, works into the idea of the novel, and it's sent out as a beacon, you know, in some way, what Jesse admits to. That was swirling around. And I don't want to exaggerate and say, oh, that was, it wasn't as intense a relationship, obviously, as Celine and Jesse have. It was just something kind of swirling around in my mind, you know. So, but it's a really, the new film's dedicated to her.
Richard Linklater, do you think there's going to be a fourth film in the Before Sunrise series?
Wow. You know, the fact that we've done it twice now, that, you know, Jesse and Celine have emerged, you know, years later and had something to say about a new place in life. I mean, on the one hand, I wouldn't be surprised. On the other hand, I know for a fact the three of us have zero ideas about that and won't have any ideas for many years. And I think we're all happily on hiatus from these two characters for quite some time. So, but, you know, who knows the future? I would like to have the option to see Jesse and Celine in some new situation in the future, you know, for the next 50 years or so. That'd be fun.
Richard Linklater directed the new film Before Midnight. He also wrote the film, along with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, who star in the movie. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.